Beyond the Tenth by Tuesday Lobsang Rampa, read for you by Blue Friend in beautiful BC. Chapter 3. John Thomas was a fine, upstanding young member of the little Welsh community, a loyal, vociferous member of the Wales for the Welsh Look You movement. He was an acknowledged leader of the group who shouted invective when the Prince of Wales-to-be appeared in the principality. Loud and shrill was he indeed when he translated strange bardic oaths into the English language and hurled them at the heads or ears of English tourists harmlessly visiting the seat of Welsh culture. Down at the Leek and Daffodil, he threw a pretty dart at the heart of the English tyrant, whatever, Look You, as he stopped for a moment or so from his endless beer imbibing. Many were the tales he told of English atrocities as he waited for his unemployment check, provided free by a parsimonious England. By night, he'd steal out with a paint pot and a brush and, first making sure he was unobserved, paint witty remarks on any convenient wall, always against the English, of course. But one day, he appeared at the Leek and Daffodil looking grim and glum, as well as morose and moody. "What is it that ails you, John Thomas?" inquired a friend. "You look kind of wilted." John Thomas sighed and groaned and wiggled his ears. "Oh, woe is me," he exclaimed, rolling his eyes heavenwards, but keeping a tight hold on his tankard. "Woe is me, my welfare has run out, and I can get no more from the filthy English. Now I shall have to work in the land of my fathers." He turned away and quickly grabbed the filled tankard of a man whose attention had been distracted. Draining the stranger's first and then his own, he hastened away. Next day, with heartfelt lamentations, he took a job as a tourist bus driver and was henceforth known as Thomas the Bus. Sadly, he drove English tourists on their excursions, answering their questions with a pleasant smile, but holding black murder in his heart. Days wore on, and Thomas the Bus wore out. More and more morose he became, Look You, and no longer was his voice raised in song. No longer did he raise the tankard for even gift beer. He grew lethargic, listless, languid, and lazy. No longer did he daub graffiti on the walls at night. No longer did he object or raise a commotion when, being detected in shortchanging his tourists, an Englishman sang, "Taffy was a Welshman, Taffy was a thief, Taffy came to our house and stole a round of beef." "It is under the weather that I am indeed," he quoted to a crony, "and I feel that my shadow is more substantial than I myself am. Perhaps I should get me forth and consult old Williams the Med." Off he tottered on shaking limbs and painfully hauled himself up the three steps to Williams the Med. Dr. Williams soon disposed of the other patients and called in Thomas the Bus, exclaiming, "Well, what is it with you, my man?" "Oh, Dr. Williams," exclaimed Thomas the Bus, "I can sing no more, and I cannot raise my tankard." He looked about furtively and then in a conspiratorial whisper mumbled, "And that's not all I can't do either." His voice sank lower and lower, and at last Dr. Williams said, "Yes, my man, I know exactly what's wrong with you. As Thomas the Bus, you are crouched over your controls, and it has constricted your bowels." His voice rose to an angry roar. "You are constipated, my man, constipated, full of useless rubbish. Would you have rubbish in your house? Wouldn't you take it outside for the sanitary attendant's attention?" Thomas the Bus hung his head in shame, and he mumbled, "Yes, my bus goes every day, but I only go once a week." I have received many, many letters, 30 or 40 a day, as I've already stated, and a surprising number are about medical problems. Many people, women especially, do not feel very happy about going to see a doctor and discussing some of the more common and perhaps embarrassing illnesses, dysfunctions, or complaints, so they write to me. In this chapter, I am going to deal with one or two health problems, but first one of all is constipation. This is probably the most insidious complaint or illness ever to afflict mankind. One takes action about other types of illness. If you have a bad toothache, you have the wretched thing yanked out. If you have a broken leg, you have the bone set. But constipation, people seem to think it is like the poor, always with us. Many people place great faith in the wise words of the doctors, but doctors are often in the hands of pharmaceutical manufacturers. The common cold, and even more common constipation, are what one might term the bread and butter illnesses of the pharmacists. Billions of pounds or dollars have been and will be spent on cures for colds and constipation. Well, the doctor abides, or should abide, by two ancient laws, the first of which states that the art of medicine consists of amusing the patient while nature cures the illness. The second is primum non nocere, which means first, do no harm. Whatever a doctor does, then, should be in accordance with those two laws. The first, gain the patient's interest and hope that nature will cure the illness, and the second, do no harm. Unfortunately, in the opinion of many people, the doctor is doing a great harm when he omits to warn people of the dangers of constipation. Constipation interests us who want to do astral travel for the sole reason that, if a person is habitually constipated, it is not possible to do conscious astral travel while one is fully awake. So, if you want to go out on astral journeys, make sure that your inside is all right first. Inner cleanliness is important, isn't it? The very ancient Chinese medical records indicate that early Chinese leaders, emperors and empresses, and great warlords used clysters to make sure that their interior was at least as clean as their exterior. A common name for clyster nowadays is enema. So let us use the common name, because clysters rather reminds one of cloisters in some old church, and we are far removed from that when we deal with enemas. The very early Chinese used narrow bamboo tubes fitted into larger tubes and that had a piston which propelled the herbal solution into the intestines. The Egyptians, as well, got into the act. Possibly they got the idea from the Chinese. But round about 1500 BC, the Egyptians were using enemas as an ordinary routine method of treating ill health. The idea was, if you have a pain inside, you get rid of all the waste product which probably causes it. Some of their enema solutions were distinctly messy. Oil and honey blended together was quite a common matter. In French times, in about 1400 or so, enemas were very much in use. Soon after that, the enema became a fashionable method of treating illness, and many very high-ranking families had at least one enema a day. In England also, the leading families had wonderful enema syringes manufactured so that the patient sat over a hole in a wooden box, and then a very ornate enema syringe was placed in position, and the handle pumped, which injected a carefully prepared liquid into the bowels of the sitting patient, after which the patient rose and departed in great haste so that the load could be discharged. But fashions change. It's not now so fashionable to use the enema. One goes instead to the local drugstore and gets a packet of this or that and either swallows, sucks, chews, or drinks some noxious concoction which all too frequently gives one a bad pain and violent expulsion, and really does nothing to cure the complaint. Does nothing to overcome that which caused the constipation. It seems now that people want to cure the symptom without curing the root cause, which, of course, is too crazy for comment. Yes, medical treatment undergoes cycles of popularity and unpopularity. It used to be that people had their tonsils removed as a fashionable thing. Then it became the fashion to have the appendix removed, and now it is the fashion for women to have hysterectomies, of which more later. But it was a very bad change in fashion when enemas were discontinued, because a correctly applied enema can do wonders in overcoming constipation. Not merely the system, but the lack of health which causes the constipation in the first place. Many people are constipated because they do not drink nearly enough water. One really must drink loads and loads of water if one is to be healthy, because we eat food and it gets churned into a paste inside, and then as it passes through the intestines, nutritious substances are extracted from the paste, and inevitably moisture also is extracted. So by time all the unwanted residue from the food gets into the descending colon, it becomes a hard, dry mass. It is expelled by spasmodic, screwing-like motions of the colon. And if the mass is too hard, then it cannot be expelled. Or if it is expelled, it causes pain and irritation. The only way to make this mass easily removed is to be sure that there is adequate moisture in it so that it remains a pliable paste. Too many of the commercial laxatives on the market today are irritants. That is, the action of the chemical in the laxative irritates the bowel and makes it twitch. Sometimes it irritates the bowel so much that moisture is drawn from the bloodstream through the wall of the colon and saturates the mass of residue, and that causes dehydration. Many of you have written to me about this very problem, and so the best thing to do is to treat first the original condition by means of a self-administered enema, and then, when that condition has been restored to normal, by a very carefully selected laxative when needed. Perhaps to save another avalanche of letters about this problem, we should go into some more detail, and so here it is. people nowadays eat artificial food, manufactured food, and frequently it lacks bulk. If a person takes food and there is not enough residue to fill the intestine, the motion of the intestine cannot push forward the residue, which we desire to excrete. So it is quite essential to have a suitable diet. The diet must include bulk enough to fill the intestine to its normal size so that the spasmodic twitching of the intestine can move forward that residue. Then the food should have roughage, which stimulates the bowel without irritating it. In much the same way as suitably applied massage can stimulate the body without irritating it. Further, one must drink a lot of water so that there is an adequate water supply to keep the blood at its correct thickness or density, and enough water to keep the kidneys active, and enough left over to keep the body waste in suitably moist condition. If one follows a normal, sensible diet, plenty of fruit and plenty of vegetables, the bowel should not trouble one unduly. But too many people perch on drugstore stools like a lot of broody hens while they crouch over a plate and absolutely shovel food into their mouths, ladling it in as quickly as possible, hardly taking a bite but swallowing as fast as they can. All this mess gets inside the stomach, and the poor old stomach has to work even harder, breaking up the stuff. Then, after one has had this meal, one rushes out to catch a bus or to do shopping during the lunch hour break. The bowels, during the day, get tired of informing their owner that they want to get working, and so the impulse gets slower and slower, weaker and weaker. Many people do not devote enough time to the calls of nature. And people, like bus drivers, for example, who are crouched up in the driver's cabin, constrict their intestines, and so constipation is almost an occupational hazard of bus drivers. People seem to think that bowels should only work when they want them to work. And they also think that there should be instant delivery. Nature doesn't work that way. You have to give nature time to work properly. And if you abuse nature, if you abuse your natural functions, you're going to pay for it with bad health, a bad temper, and a bad bank account. Now, you know what an enema is? You can get, from a drugstore, a suitable rubber bag with a length of tubing that has a nozzle at the end. With any decent enema bag, there will be instructions for use. And it is very, very seriously suggested that you shall use an enema for a few times to get your health in good condition. Because when your intestines have been reconditioned, then you should not again suffer from constipation, unless you have some grave disease, in which case you should be in the care of your doctor. Please remember that I'm not trying to replace your family doctor. I'm not prescribing what one might term medical treatment. I am instead trying to save you a lot of misery by telling you some elementary facts which everyone should know, and which, if people would listen, would save them years of illness and much expense with a doctor who really has more important cases to attend to. So, will you remember that? I'm not prescribing medical attention for people with serious illnesses. I'm suggesting a treatment, a routine which will help you to keep good health, and that means avoiding constipation. It is always safe to give an enema, and the best position is when the patient lies perhaps on a towel on the bathroom floor. Lie on the left side with your knees drawn up. You can administer the enema yourself without any difficulty. If you have some really bad constipation trouble, it is a very good idea to have a 1/2 ounce of tincture of myrrh and about 15 drops of tincture of echinacea. These should be added to a quart of water, which is at approximately body temperature. Put this in your enema bag and inject it into the bowels. Keep it in as long as you possibly can, and the mixture will saturate the hard mass within the bowels and make it soft so that it may be passed without any pain. After you have expelled the first lot, have another enema injection, but this time with a quart of body temperature water, to which only 15 drops of echinacea has been added. That means you do not have the tincture of myrrh with the second enema. This second injection will help you get rid of any pus or catarrh which is lodged within your lower bowel. You may be interested to know that many patients who cannot take food through the mouth and throat can be fed per rectum. A nourishing liquid food is very slowly injected and retained, and that nourishes the body. Remember, the more quickly you inject any solution into the rectum, the more quickly it is expelled. And if you want to retain a healing liquid for some time, then the enema should be given very slowly. Naturally, you will only inject liquid food under orders of your doctor. Native tribes throughout the world have their own cures for constipation. The natives of South America, specifically in the interior of Brazil, gave us one of our most famous laxatives, cascara, or, as it is correctly termed, cascara sagrada, the sacred bark. Natives of Brazil go to their witch doctor when they are constipated and get a piece of the sacred bark, which they then chew, and a ghastly taste it has, too. After they've chewed it for a bit, they discreetly retire into some dense bushes and are not seen again for some little time. When they do appear, they are much better in health, but possibly a little pale from all the events which have happened. Sacred bark, just chewed, has a most devastating effect, but now it has been tamed by chemists, and it can be obtained in very suitable graded doses. When you've got your interior freed from clogging waste, you should check your diet and alter it as and when necessary, and you should then ensure regularity of bowel movements by eating properly and by making a habit of attending to the calls of nature. Go at the same time each day. Never mind if, for a day, you cannot get any result. Still sit there and think about it. If you make an absolute habit of it and show nature that you are there ready and willing, nature will oblige if you are there ready and willing. The best laxatives that you can take are the herbal ones. You can get cascara sagrada in tablets or in liquid, and you can get senna in tablets or in liquid. These will produce the desired action without pain. Some of the other chemical concoctions on the market are really dreadfully dangerous, but one could call cascara Faith Pills. And you will remember that faith moves mountains. Oh yes, and do not forget that it is useless to take a laxative unless you drink enough water. What is the use of taking a laxative which can cause bowel movements when the stuff you want to move is too hard to be moved? It is an utter essential that when you take a laxative, you drink a lot of water. Otherwise, the laxative will just cause pain without producing any good results. Remember, you cannot drink too much water. If you try to drink too much, well, you just find that you can't. So, your health depends very largely upon having a clean interior. If you have a clean interior, then you can get on and do astral traveling. Another thing which I have been asked to write about by many women is the change of life, the menopause. Many women fear this worse than death. They think they'll go insane or something. They have listened to some truly fantastic tales, and they fear the worst without knowing anything about it. The menopause is a time of change, but you had a change when you became adolescent. A woman doesn't become a childbearer overnight. What happens is that a girl child ambles along in childish ways until she is, well, it varies with the individual, but 12, 13, 14 years of age, and all the time she's aware of strange things happening inside her. Her attitude to life changes. Her body changes too, because at a certain time of her life, various new chemicals are being manufactured by the body and released into the bloodstream. The girl then finds she has her first period, and after she's had her first period, she is capable of bearing a child. But this changing from childhood to adolescence means that all sorts of chemicals are pouring into her blood, preparing her for motherhood, making her one of the possible child bearers. But then, at a certain time in her life, the supply of chemicals gradually dies out or dries up, and the woman all too often feels that she is now useless, feels that she cannot have a child any longer, so everything will be different. She feels that she won't have any sex life. It's crazy, of course. Many people have the happiest time of their life when they've entered menopause. Many people find that they become great artists or great designers or great musicians after the childbearing age is over. Nature takes away the childbearing potentialities, but all the energy, all the initiative, everything can then go into other things. Women ask me how they should behave at the menopause. The answer is, remember, you are undergoing change. You are like a car which for years has been running on petrol, and suddenly it has to run on paraffin. With adjustment, it can be done quite satisfactorily. Remember that the menopause is utterly natural. Every woman gets it, and the only ones who are badly affected are those who worry too much. There is no need to bother about it. Realize that changes are taking place. Realize that if you keep calm about it, the changes will be affected more quickly. You may have rather more headaches than average for you, that is, when the menopause is taking place, but that will pass. Soon, things will level out, and you won't get any feelings of strangeness anymore. You won't get any monthly disturbances anymore either. You'll be happier. Many people put on a little weight after the menopause because the various chemicals which have now been stopped made a person quite attractive and burned up excess fat. With the stoppage of those chemicals, a body can get a little plump. But with suitable dieting, suitable exercise, you can control that and look even better. Do not, under any circumstances, believe old wives' tales who tell you that you'll get as fat as a pig, you'll enter a mental home, you'll have a beard and a mustache, and all that rubbish. The menopause is natural. It's quite ordinary. But if you do get too upset or disturbed, your doctor can prescribe suitable hormone treatment for you. Now, you cannot prescribe hormones for yourself because there are many different types of hormones, and if you take the wrong type, they're not going to do you a bit of good. If you find life too insupportable during the menopause stage, see your doctor. Tell him straight out that you want something done about it. Many doctors, sad to say, think that the menopause is so ordinary that it's just a waste of time. It's just childishness for a woman to complain. And if your doctor is like that, then you tell him straight out what you want and see you get it. And if he won't give you hormone treatment, go to some doctor who will, because doctors are two a penny, you know. While we're on the subject of women's complaints, let us refer to that operation known as hysterectomy. Now, many women are having hysterectomies without knowing what it's all about. Hysterectomy is almost a status symbol with some women, just the same as wearing those comic plastic helmets is a status symbol in Canada or the USA. Men who want to be known as rugged he-men wears a silly little plastic helmet of various colors to denote their grade, such as building, scaffolding, digging ditches, or gardening. Yes, even gardeners wear those funny little helmets over there. So women, then, are using hysterectomy as a status symbol. It's the newest form of thing, just as people had their tonsils out, then they had their appendix out, and now they're having their ovaries out. Many women, married women, yes, the unmarried ones as well, will not bother about birth control. Instead, they have a hysterectomy, which is the removal of the womb and ovaries, and then they just can't have any babies anymore. So they can have as much sex as they want, and everything is quite safe. It's not as easy as all that. Hysterectomy is a very bad thing indeed, unless one has a very definite disease. If your doctor tells you that you have a disease and you need a hysterectomy, do not just take his word for it. Go and get another opinion. Regrettably, it's an easy matter to tell a woman to have an operation. It doesn't hurt the doctor, and it brings in some money, you know, and doctors are becoming more and more businessmen. They have to live. They have to pay for expensive cars and establishments. And if a woman is willing to pay for an operation, well, it doesn't hurt the doctor. You will understand that I have no faith in these Western doctors. Having had some experience of them in Canada, I think they're nothing but glorified butchers. But back to our hysterectomy. If it is quite essential for you to have the operation, remember that it is in effect an artificial menopause, an artificial change of life. You are not a useless cabbage after it. You can lead a perfectly normal life. And the only difference in your outlook is that you cannot have babies anymore. It is very, very wrong, though, for a young woman of, let us say, 25 to 30, to have a hysterectomy as a form of birth control, because a woman of 40 or 50 has lived a normal sex life, and her body and over self have become matured accordingly. But if, before any maturing occurs, the drastic operation of hysterectomy takes place, then the woman doesn't have any of these experiences, which come with periods, etc., etc. If nature wanted women to have a change of life at 25 years of age, nature would have arranged it accordingly. And it is not right for man to alter nature just for stupid, idle whims, but only when there is gross disease which cannot be cured by other means. So, ladies, if you have to have a hysterectomy, act as if you have had a serious operation and a change of life at the same time, because that's what it is. Remember that with a normal, natural change of life, the cessation of flow of various chemicals has taken place over quite a length of time. But if you have had a hysterectomy, then you get a quite drastic cessation of flow and a difference of chemical output. That is why some women get a bit peculiar when they've had a hysterectomy, because everything has been too drastic and they did not know what to expect. What to expect is this: you have to recover from the physical shock of the operation, and you have to get used to a difference in your chemical composition. You have to realize that for a time you will feel disoriented, lost, and unsure of yourself. You may be trembly, you may have headaches, you may have vague pains in the lower part of your body, but if you will let them, they will pass, and you can do normal things again. You can enjoy sex, you can enjoy sports. But it all depends upon your attitude, upon your frame of mind, because as you think, so you are. One of the big causes of hysterectomy, frigidity, etc., in women, well, a man wouldn't have hysterectomy now, would he? Is that parents of the old school often told their children horrible things about sex. Mothers, a few years ago, taught their daughters that sex was terrible, horrible, despicable, disgusting, and just about every other thing in that line, with the result that they preconditioned their daughters to abhor sex, preconditioned the daughter to be the one responsible for failure in marriage. I know a woman who was so utterly terrified about sex by her mother that although she is now, in name, a married woman, she knows nothing about her husband's body, and he knows the same about her. He's a good-natured fellow without any sex drive, without any ambition, as one would expect from the foregoing. And these people live a life as exciting as a lettuce and a cabbage living together in the same shelf of the freezer. I mentioned sex once to this woman, and she nearly threw a fit with embarrassment, horror, and shock. And in my considered opinion, she is just about insane because of the fear of sex. She is always afraid of being raped. It's a tragic thing that mothers shall give their daughters such a wholly false idea about sex. But not only mothers are to blame. Many people who claim to be occultists tell others that sex is unclean. Sex stops one from progressing in occult studies. Nothing could be further from the truth. There are certain people who need sex, and there are others who do not. You cannot class humans all in one bunch. What suits one group does not suit the other. And I state quite definitely that there is no harm in sex, but only good, provided the practitioners of the art are in love with each other. If they are not in love, then the sex act is nothing but elimination, the same as other eliminations of the body. Unfortunately, certain churches, notably the Catholic Church, teach a lot of rot about sex. So far as I've been able to determine, the Catholic Church was started by a lot of old men who were scared stiff of women, but they were not so scared of other men and small boys. That may shock some, but if any of you are shocked, then get down to a bit of study and find out for yourself. If you have some money, go along to the Vatican, and if you can think of a good enough story, you'll be able to see some of the books, history books, in the libraries. And in connection with this, it amuses me immensely to know that in the Vatican, there is the biggest collection of erotica, or pornographic pictures, of anywhere in the Western world, and yet the Catholics preach against sex. Sex is normal. Sex is natural. Sex is utterly necessary to some people. And anyhow, what right has a Catholic priest to dictate to other people? How can a Catholic priest, an unmarried man, tell a married woman what she should or should not do? He's talking about things of which he knows nothing, or should know nothing, if he truly is a Catholic priest. Perhaps we should start a campaign against breathing. Let us tell some of these Catholic priests that they commit a mortal sin every time they draw a breath, or every time they attend the calls of nature. By the look of some of them, they don't commit many mortal sins, do they? You'll gather from this that I do not like Catholic priests, and that is perfectly correct. I think they are a bigoted lot. Instead of research to find anything out about the Bible, to find out anything about the founder of Christianity, they just swallow the Bible lock, stock, and barrel. Take that old tale about Adam and Eve, the serpent and the apple. Well, according to Eastern teachings, the serpent becomes the male organ, and the apple is the container which holds the seed. And if you read some of the Bible in the light of Eastern knowledge, you will agree that there's quite a lot in the Eastern way of thinking. Moses was found in the bulrushes. Sure, he was found in the bulrushes, but he was placed there by the gardeners of the earth, that is, the people who are known as UFO people, to be found. And later in life, Moses ascended into the mountains. Moses did a lot of strange things, but if you reread the relevant chapters, you'll find that Moses stepped upon a terraced floor. Did he do that on a mountain, or did he step into a flying ship, a UFO? Moses had a rod of power. It wasn't made on earth. You know, it was made on another world. Moses was, in fact, another spaceman specially planted on Earth. We will deal more with that type of thing in the next chapter, but I want to put on record that for sheer bigotry and ignorance, the Roman Catholic priest is hard to beat. I know, I've met loads of them, and I don't like any of them. I have tried to discuss religion with them sensibly and with an honest desire for knowledge, but the Catholic priest always loses his temper, fiddles with his collar, turns red, and bolts. So much for Catholic priests. Now, I get frequent letters from people who are interested in drugs like LSD, marijuana, peyote, and all the rest of the junk. A surprising number of such people write to me from prisons throughout the USA. They ask me what I think of LSD, what I think of marijuana, and all the rest of it. And it might be interesting to put my definite opinion down here. LSD, marijuana, peyote, and all these drugs are terribly, terribly harmful to the over-self. If you want to injure yourself, well, that's your own choice, but it's not a good thing to injure your over-self, because down here, you're only 1/10 conscious, so you don't know what the other 9/10 want. Drugs of this type tangle the silver cord, make depressions and twists in the aura, and leave harmful scars on the astral body. There is no sense whatever in injuring your body just in search of fresh sensations, which are false sensations anyhow. The only use for any of these drugs is in the hands of qualified medical researchers who can be assumed to know what they're doing, or they wouldn't be qualified medical researchers. My advice is, and this advice never varies, stay away from drugs. If you have to have medical attention requiring drugs, see your doctor. But don't meddle with drugs yourself. You will be doing more harm than you can imagine possible. So that brings us on to another subject. Many people seem to think that they are committing a crime if they have any illness. I had a letter from a lady who was of the opinion that she could not make any spiritual progress, any occult progress, because she had a physical infirmity. She was most distressed, thinking that she had sinned greatly in having a body that was not perfect. Do you know, the really healthy person just cannot do any occult work at all. Look at some of the football players, the baseball players, and all those people. Just look at a photograph of them. They might be lumps of meat, but too many of them seem to be lacking in the top story. Just look at those photographs of popular players and express your own opinion. Quite seriously, though, I tell you that so far as I am aware, one has to have some infirmity before one can be really psychic. The great oracle of Tibet was a sick man, a very sick man indeed, and a very accurate one in his prophecies. If you dig down in research, you'll find that all occultists who are genuine have some physical disability which increases their rate of vibration up to a point where they're able to perceive, either by clairvoyance or telepathy or some other way. That's something for you to think about. Many times a person has an infirmity or illness, not because he or she is working out karma, but so that he or she can have the personal vibration increased to such an extent that higher frequencies may be received and occult phenomena may be experienced. People write to me and say that I must have a terrible karma to work out because I have had coronary thrombosis, TB, and a few other complaints, and because I have truly had such a terribly hard life. But no, it's not working out karma at all. It is for the purpose of doing a special task. So please, do not write again telling me I must have been very wicked in the past life, or I would not have suffered so much in this. I know what I was in the past life. I know what I am doing, and I know where I am going. And I would get there a lot faster if there were more people to help. I have tried to do a special research in the matter of the human aura. I have tried to produce a special device so that anyone can see the aura. But always there is the question of money. If one tries to get money for research, then one is automatically suspect. I have tried to get people to study, but there again, people are scared stiff of being parted from anything between their shoes and their hat. But I do assure you, no, I am not working out karma. Instead, I am doing a special task. It is unfortunate that so much about human bodies enters into that task because always there is the thought in people's mind, oh, he wants money. Oh, he wants sex. Well, in the latter, they are quite wrong. But it does give me an opportunity of saying that the so-called promiscuous Norwegians or Scandinavians are quite right in their attitudes towards sex, quite right in their attitude towards the human body. After all, Christians claim that the human body is made in the image of God, and then they go and spoil everything by being afraid to show the image of God. The Scandinavians are not like that. They're more broad-minded, as are quite a number of Europeans and, of course, the Japanese. But American people, or rather North American people, are really frightfully immature when it comes to human bodies and sex. They don't know what love is. All they want to do is sit in a convertible under the light of the moon and neck. They want to poke and prod and squeeze and stir up all the emotions while denying nature the last emotion of all. And in doing this necking stunt, they build up frustration, misunderstanding, and unhappiness. However, North America is a young continent yet, and I look upon them as toddlers experimenting with themselves and with others, and just starting the long process of growing up. In ordinary sex, for instance, even with a married couple who may be staying with their parents, they are afraid to make love in case the parents will hear. Well, good gracious me, if the parents hadn't done the same thing some time before, there wouldn't be this married couple now, would there? Which brings us back to what I said before. There is nothing wrong in sex, provided it is done with love. And the people who preach against sex are preaching against the strongest thing in human life. And in my opinion, they are just crackpots. I have just received a letter which asks me about people who are dying. Is it true, the letter asks, that people often smile when they're dying? Yes, they do. Anyone who has had much to do with the very ill and the dying can testify to this. Most people, when they're at the point of death, smile and look happy. They look, in fact, as if they'd just been met by loved ones, which is indeed the case. When your time comes to leave this earth, then, be of good cheer, for you will be met, you will be helped, and there is nothing whatever to fear. On the other side of this life, at the other side of the curtain we call death, there is happiness, light, and joy. But wait for it, wait for it. You cannot die before your time. And if you try to, you'll get slapped back here in worse conditions. It's worth waiting for, though. It's a very pleasant experience as soon as you have left this earth. I have said quite a lot about doctors and said they are to a penny. Yes, the average sort of doctor nowadays is just a businessman. He's out to make a living. He's just out to make as much money as he can. So if you consider you have some illness which needs treatment, you should search around a bit and find a good doctor. Find the best general practitioner you can. The general practitioner differs from the specialist in that the former can diagnose and treat almost any type of illness. You will hear reports of doctors if you will make inquiries. Inquire of your friends. Inquire about a doctor at a shop or shops. And if you find you cannot get on with the first doctor, well, good gracious me, there are plenty of them. Try another. You should be warned, though, that when you have found a good general practitioner, hang on to him. He's worth his weight in gold and platters of diamonds. When you have your good general practitioner, let him tell you if you need the services of a specialist. He knows the human body, its functions, and its malfunctions better than you do. So get to know a good general practitioner. Get to know him and trust him and tell him all your symptoms. Never use your druggist as a prescribing agency. A druggist may be exceptionally good as a druggist, but he's not necessarily qualified to be a general practitioner. So your doctor should be the one to diagnose and the one to prescribe, and the druggist is the one who fills the prescription. I'm going to make myself frightfully unpopular here. I'm going to advise you that if you are ill, definitely your best choice is an orthodox, common, or garden general practitioner. Avoid spiritualistic healers and others who do not have scientific training because, just for a simple example, it is utterly easy to hypnotize a person into believing that he does not have such and such an illness or such and such a symptom. You can cure that illness, but unless you know enough about bodies and medicine to get down to basics, you can easily start up a far worse illness. By meddling with spiritualistic stuff, or hypnotic healers who do not have any medical training, you can turn an ordinarily harmless lump into a cancerous tissue. So be very sure that if you are ill, you go to an orthodox general practitioner who has the necessary medical training. Many people are bemused by the different medical specialties. So, for your reference, let us mention just a few of the more common ones in alphabetical order. Allergy is the study of altered reactions of the body to certain substances. Anesthesiology is the medical specialty of administering anesthetics, in other words, killing the pain. Dermatology deals with skin diseases. Endocrinology relates to the study of glands and their internal secretions. Gastroenterology relates to stomach and intestines. Hematology is the science of the blood. Neurology deals with the nervous system. It's hardly worth mentioning obstetrics and gynecology or ophthalmology because everyone knows that the first is to deal with babies, etc., or rather their production, the second with female diseases in general, and ophthalmology deals with eye troubles. The nurse in the hospital says ENT, meaning ear, nose, and throat. If she was correct or highbrow, she would be saying otology, laryngology, and rhinology. Pediatrics is the medical science of dealing with children's diseases. The proctologist could almost get an advanced naval rank because unkind people refer to the proctologist as the rear admiral because he inspects the rear, that is, diseases of the anus and rectum. Psychiatry is the science of mental diseases. Radiology is X-ray work. Thoracic surgery is surgery within the chest cavity. Urology, for our last one, which deals with anything to do with the urogenital tract, and that is the kidneys, the bladder, and the sex organs. So now you have some nice big words, and you know what your general practitioner means if he should tell you or one of your friends that you should see a so-and-so. End of chapter 3.